folks, it's time for Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show about the crucial political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and the nation at large. Join us for a stimulating, thought-provoking discussion. You'll get the facts as we focus on the challenges facing everyone. Good morning, folks. Welcome to Democratic Perspective. And we've got a full house today. I see three people sitting across from me and a couple of people. Claudia, who does the video videotape, is sitting back there. And we have another guest, Charles Hilton.
Yes, we want to remind people that this is live streamed on Facebook. You can be in Timbuktu and see Democratic Perspective. I'm not sure why you'd want to do that, but yeah,
you can sit and watch us talk if you want. I think what most people do is just put it on their computers and, you know, and then walk away.
Well, you could, you'd be missing, first of all, you'd be missing this really wonderful hat.
I know.
And you'd be missing our guest today, who's going to talk about some really cool stuff.
Klaus, you want to introduce our guest here?
Yeah, once you introduce me, but I'll introduce myself.
Oh, that's right. Klaus von Stutterheim. Is that close?
Not that. You're getting close.
I'm getting better. I went to Germany. I learned a whole lot.
By the time I die, you'll have it figured out.
Yeah. Maybe.
We have a... what I consider a very special guest today, close friend of mine, Greg Munro, who taught at the University of Montana Law School, and his specialty was liability suits, and then was the dean for a couple of years, and then finally retired and is now roaming the world. And given his background, I thought it would be really interesting to hear from him about class action suits. Are they just a way to bleed corporations and poor doctors who have to pay huge insurance premium, and that's what keeps medical costs high? Or is it just the only defense that consumers have to get their say? So was the description accurate?
I think so. That characterizes the issues or the general issues that are going on.
Well, I meant about you.
Oh, yeah, except I was an interim dean. I wasn't actually a dean. I was interim while we found the permanent dean.
Well, that'll do. You know, we don't have that many deans here, right, Mike? So, you know, any dean will do in a crunch. All right, so class action suits, and there's been a campaign maybe for 30 years to limit the ability of individuals and groups to sue for redress. And there's a very, very intense campaign, plaintiff campaign around. And we have all these wonderful examples of how class action suits have worked and helped people. But there's this ferocious opposition to them. Trial lawyers are evil and the whole rest of it. So tell us a little bit about why are class action suits? Why is it important for Americans to have the right to do this? Because it seems to me that Americans have been giving up right and left their rights to be able to sue. And really suing is the only redress for a lot of civil violations.
Yeah, you know, let's talk about class actions. First, class actions are they're the action that consumers or citizens can bring when their numbers, the number of people who've been wronged generally by corporations, is so large that you won't be able to name them all or handle them all in one lawsuit. So they let a couple people, one person or more, represent the whole class of people. So that's what it's about. It's a very relevant topic in the United States today. And by the way, this is nothing new. Class actions came about in 1842. And then we made changes in 1938, 1966, and 2005, which I'll talk about more in a minute. The reason they're so relevant right now is because in every state, we have a maximum of law, and in Montana, it's enshrined in our Constitution, that for every legal wrong, there is a remedy. And the problem is, if a large corporation injures or wrongs thousands of people or millions of people for $75 a piece or $2,000 a piece, none of them have redress because I can't go after, I can't find any lawyer anywhere who's going to handle a case for me against a corporation in Birmingham, Alabama, from Montana for $75. And so if corporations discover, and they have, that they can make hundreds of millions of dollars by defrauding insured or defrauding consumers out of $150 a piece, and there's not going to be any redress. They'll just ignore your letters, they'll ignore your phone calls, and you've got to take them to court, and you can't do it. So that's why class actions came about. And today, more than ever before, in the United States, if you believe, as I do, that inequity, income inequity, is bad for a society, and if we have this process going on where the opportunity and the wealth and the power is falling into the hands of a smaller and smaller group of corporations and wealthy people, then you've got to have class actions, because if you don't, you'll run into real problems. Now, you can watch, right? And so the answer is, today, one of the only ways to hold a corporation responsible for when they go outside bounds is the class actions. And that is why class actions have been a favorite target of what we'll call tort reformers. It's not tort reformers. It's people who want to get, as you pointed out, get rid of citizen or consumer rights to redress these small wrongs.
So let's underline that, Greg, that it's the only means of redress in this situation. For instance, pollution, a recent movie I saw based on fact of pollution, kills a man's cow, people get sick in West Virginia, and so forth and so on. Their only redress is the class action suit. As individuals, they have no chance whatsoever of getting redress, right?
The only way they'll have chance is if their suit is big enough to bring it.
Yeah.
But, you know, we trial lawyers, you know, if the case isn't worth several hundred thousand dollars, you can't put it in a jury trial these days. Medical malpractice and products liability cases, the American Association of Justice, if you go to their schools, they'll teach you that, you know, don't take them unless you have hundreds of thousands and probably millions of dollars involved.
Well, that's a little more history. We heard tort reform from the Democrats in the late 90s. We heard tort reform from the Bush administration in the early part of this century. Tort reform, tort reform, tort reform, until it was painted as something really desirable, because those blood-sucking lawyers, we all know those blood-sucking lawyers don't have, and yet it, as you were pointing out, at least on this show, it is an attempt by the corporate world, by the Koch brothers, to deny one of the basic rights of humanity, as far as I'm concerned, but certainly one of the basic rights of Americans.
They really want to take away your right to redress when you're injured. That's what you're talking about, tort reform. That's what tort reform has actually been about.
So we don't hear tort reform so much anymore. Have people woken up, or has it already succeeded?
Well, it's already succeeded. They've got a large number of things they wanted. Joint several liability, where if you sued a couple of defendants and you got a verdict against them, you could go after one of those defendants for all the money. In many states, like Montana, they've severely restricted that. To a certain extent, it's been successful. They've had many things. And, you know, they've instituted all kinds of caps. And I'll give you an example. Many states have a medical malpractice cap. If I'm rendered quadriplegic by a trucking company, I can recover $5 million, $50 million. If I'm rendered quadriplegic by a doctor or a hospital in Montana, my non-economic recovery is limited to $250,000. So there's an example of a very successful tort reform. And all it does is take away people's rights. This is a point that we should make. The tort reformers in Cook County in Chicago, they did a study of the cases that are filed there. The tort reformers use the court more than anybody else. Big corporations sue more than anybody sues. And the overwhelming number of cases filed are business suits, collection suits, suits against consumers. And so they're all for using the courts. They just don't want consumers using the courts. And all of it is part of a move to put more power in the hands of the wealthiest and the corporations.
it really doesn't serve another purpose. I think people don't think deeply about it. So if you're injured with medical malpractice, your only route to any kind of redress is a lawsuit. And people don't like the idea that it's based on money, but I'm very unlikely to be able to put the malfactor in jail. There's one case in Texas where the guy committed so many injuries to people that they actually put him in jail. But in Texas, they also capped, and we're getting a little off the subject, we'll get back to class action, they capped what your medical malpractice lawsuit, and the number of lawsuits dropped radically, I think 40-50%. That means that all those people who would have filed the lawsuit, who believe that they had been injured or their relatives have been injured, have been not denied basically due process and redress for their injury. And redress is fundamental in American law. Otherwise, we really don't have a corporate.
You don't have
state.
A rule of law.
Yeah.
Before we go back to class actions, I want to say one more thing on the tort reform. If you want the greatest tort reform ever, if you want to shrink the plaintiff's bar till it damn near doesn't exist, enact universal health care. All you have to do is I practiced, and I probably had 1,000 different claims, and I've been practicing plaintiff's tort law for 45 years. None of my clients come to me because they want to hit a liability. Jackpot, as you heard in the ads, they don't come to me because they want money. They come to me in tears because they think they're going to be bankrupt because of their medical expense. Montanans don't want to be in court. They don't like lawyers.
Yeah, and I think that's the general feel. Klaus, you...
You made a reference to reform law, I assume, 2015. What was that about?
No, I think they mentioned the Class Action Fairness Act of 2005. And as is
how
the case,
fair is that act?
Yeah, well, is the case, as you're pointing out now, as is the case with many things that are titled like that coming out of Congress, you can expect they're doing the exact opposite. The Class Action Fairness Act, believe me, it had nothing to do with fairness to consumers. It was designed for fairness to corporations. And all it did was place a great number of restrictions on. Now, one of the biggest restrictions is federal court is the favorite place for corporations, insurance companies, and banks. They want to be in federal court. They get treated much better there for some reason. And so when Congress passed the CAFA, almost all class actions have to be in federal court. You can file them in state court, but the manufacturer of the corporation can drag them into federal court in most cases. If the case involves over 100 claimants and involves over $5 million, as a general rule, they're going to be able to move it to federal court. So that was one of the biggest things.
So moving it to federal court sounds like a non-issue, but it's actually shifting it to a more favorable environment for corporations.
It, from my experience, it truly is. And I work in the insurance world. I taught insurance law and regulation. I've handled insurance cases against insurance companies my whole life. And those cases, every chance an insurance company gets, they move the case to federal court. So most of our insurance litigation, I shouldn't say most, but a great deal of it is in federal court for that reason. And the class actions, getting them into federal court, was a big boon for the special interest.
Well, let's get specific right away. Even though there's lots to talk about theoretically and what has happened, current class action suits, roundup cases, what's going on there?
You know, and I can't tell you exactly what's going on with roundup cases right now. I don't know, but what you need to know, here's the process. The lawyers find they have somebody who comes in with an injury, like injured by roundup,
right?
And they see they've got bad injuries, and they'll decide, and then they'll see that this is widespread. And so they will pick that person as a representative, that person or maybe four others. They'll pick them as representatives of that class, and they'll file their lawsuit in court. Then they'll move for class certification. They can get class certification for if they can meet four criteria. One, numerosity. They have to have so many plaintiffs that we wouldn't want to deal with them one at a time, or wouldn't want to name them one at a time. Two, The adequacy of the representation. I'm skipping a step here, but numerosity, the I'm missing the word. They have to have similar. They all have to have very similar complaints.
Right.
So they were injured by. So you could represent the class of farmers who've been injured by Roundup, and then the disputes immediately going to arise whether these people all have similar complaints. And then whether the class representative is representative of the class, and whether the people involved, the lawyers and that representative, can adequately represent the class in litigation. If they meet those criteria, the court, with that and other criteria, may say, yes, we'll certify you as a class. If they don't certify as a class, then they've got to handle the suits individually. But they'll certify as a class, and then they'll start discovery. And generally, the corporations are going to fight discovery like crazy. Discovery means going through this court-sanctioned process of getting all this information, either through what they call depositions, sworn testimony of people in the corporation, or getting their documents or asking them questions that they have to answer under oath. So they'll go through that process, and at some point they'll start negotiations. And negotiations can occur anytime. Almost all class actions, and I mean almost all, are settled. You won't see a class action in a jury trial. And they get settled along the line. Some are settled very fast because the corporation has really made bad press, and they don't want the press out of this, and they don't want to be in the newspaper, and they get it settled as fast as they can, and they know they're going to be ultimately liable for a terrible amount of money.
But sometimes, Greg, the injury is very complicated, and the companies will come up with their doctors and their experts to try to prove that there was no injury. And so it becomes a really complex issue if you come from the other side. They have all the money and all the time in the world.
Right.
And the plaintiffs, the lawyers for the plaintiffs, have to take a percentage of whatever the suit results in, which means they're taking a gamble on the issue.
Yes.
And that there's pressure, I would think, to try to settle settle a suit more quickly, because, I mean, the corporate lawyers have all the time in the world. They bill out by the hour. I mean, so the defense is billing out by the hour, and the plaintiffs are billing out by hope we able to punish these guys.
Well, the plaintiffs' attorneys are investing tons of money, and they're never going to get it back. That's being invested in the case. I mean, what I mean is they're never going to get it back if they don't prevail.
Right. In terms of a massive amount of time, I don't want to go to a recent movie and name it, but I believe it was, Blackwater, Darkwater, and it was the complexity of proving that the chemicals used to make Teflon were damaging.
Oh, terrible.
Terrible. And even though it's a huge damage that was created for hundreds and hundreds of people, proving it, getting it through a whole court process, arbitration was sort of a nightmare. Well,
that's it. That's the same thing with Roundup, that your lymphoma has three more cells than his lymphoma, and they'll argue that it's different. So they keep knocking down the class and reducing the class.
Yep. And every human being reacts to Roundup or something differently. Some will never be affected, will never have a cancer. Others will get sick immediately and die. And so that's what happens. The defense attorneys, they attack on those four grounds, and they just attack all the way through and say none of these things fit. Now, one thing we should note, sometimes it's beneficial to the corporation to have a class action going. And there are even cases where I believe the corporation has gone to class action plaintiffs' lawyers and said, why don't you bring a class action here? Because do they really want to cope with 45,000 individual lawsuits?
Right.
And so class actions are not necessarily bad for corporations and good for consumers. Sometimes it's in everybody's interest to do them. And then the other thing is you run into a situation where the corporation is going to be bankrupt. So there's going to have to be a lot of negotiations. They're going to have to get their insurance and figure out how much of their future income they're going to put, because issues come up. Do you want to put the corporation out of business? Or would you rather they keep working and put a certain amount of their profits into this fund that we've all agreed is going to pay the people? And then you've got big issues, too, about is the court going to say that everybody affected by Roundup has to be in this lawsuit? And if you're not a member of the class, you will never recover.
Don't they usually do that, Greg? Don't they say if you're not a part of the lawsuit, then forget it, or you would have to make an individual suit? Or
if there's a limited fund, they may say if you're not part of the lawsuit, forget it. What they generally do is give everybody notice, and you have a, and sometimes the judge will say this is a mandatory. You got to be in it, but you can opt out. You've got to come in, but then you can opt out. If you don't opt out, you're bound by it. So there are, the issues involved in class actions are enormous. And they're, the big rule is they're controlled by the judge, and by a couple of other acts. The multi-district litigation, they call it, is an act, a federal act that controls, so they can put all the cases in one district. I did a great deal of work in asbestos. And asbestos, as you were pointing out, you know, at first they denied that that mesothelioma, a cancer of the pleural lining of the lungs, was caused by asbestos. And the manufacturers fought that forever. There's no question that the only thing that causes mesothelioma is asbestos.
Literally the only thing.
Yeah, but beyond that, it comes back to what you were talking about. One person gets asbestosis. One person shows no signs but clearly has a load of asbestos in their lungs. And the next person dies immediately from mesothelioma. And so that's the problem. Are the claims all compatible? And is it fair to the corporation to treat everybody the same?
Well, that was the latest movie. And, of course, you know, in Oklahoma we had whistleblowers getting killed in a famous case back in I think it was back in the 60s.
Really?
Yeah. I guess my question is there. So let me get this right. There is no other way people can get redress. If Roundup kills your animals or causes you to have cancer, you let's put it this way. You either sue the corporations or you're screwed.
There's no question about it. Your attorneys can write a demand letter, put a demand brochure out to the company. With something like Roundup, your chances of ever having the company respond are probably nil. For one thing, they don't want to establish precedent as to what's going to happen. They've got this big crop of cases out there. But in my experience is, it's not going to do you any good to write an asbestos manufacturer or Roundup or anybody like that. You're going to end up in a lawsuit. You're going to have to sue.
As important as class actions are, as we're pointing out on this show, they've limited its effectiveness to almost being ineffective. Mesothelioma is an excellent example where everybody knows and the corporations put aside billions of dollars to pay claimants, and yet they will still, if they can prove that your mesothelioma wasn't as bad as his, you're going to get, if you die, you're going to get $100,000, he's going to get $50,000.
Yeah, And the other thing is, every worker I ever had, we had three giant refineries in Billings, Montana. Mm-hmm. They were built from 1938 to 1948. Everybody smoked cigarettes. It would be unheard of not to be a cigarette smoker. So when you try these cases, the defense attorneys are there, 25 of them sitting around a room, while one of them hammers your client to death about their cigarettes. Did your doctor tell you to quit smoking? Did you tell your doctor you smoked?
So your responsibility. Now, are the lawsuits, suppose cigarettes contributed, they would argue cigarettes contributed something to your lung cancer, but asbestos did more. Is there a way of balancing that out?
Yes. Now, a lot of states have what we call the Callahan rule in Montana. If you can't separate out the causation, then you'll be able to recover for the asbestos. Asbestos, the industry knew that there's a synergistic relationship between asbestos and cigarette. The cigarette smoker is much more likely to get mesothelioma or asbestosis. So they knew that. So that it often backfires on them. But that's what they do. They try every issue in the world. And, you know, that's fair. That's what their job is. But that's how they break the uniformity. You know, that, no, his cancer is different than yours, and it's not fair to put him. You can't certify this as a class. And as you point out, they simply have made it over the years, and especially with this, the Class Action Fairness Act, have made it more and more difficult. The hurdles are immense. And that's why you have giant corporations. You also have firms that are big. They're financially healthy, and they can put $90 million into a single class action. So they've grown with the size of the corporations, and they can bankroll a class action. So there are firms in the United States that can handle the biggest class actions, but that's why Congress keeps stepping in and making it harder and harder and harder.
Well, that's it. I want to talk about how can we fix this. This is a basic American right that has been taken away, as far as I'm concerned, by mostly Republicans, but in the earlier part of the century, plenty of cooperation of plenty of Democrats. This came over a period of years with laws year after year after year, till finally we have what in 2020 is almost completely ineffective class action laws, class action rules that make suits.
So to go to Mike's question, and Mike, I would add to that.
How can we fix this? Can we fix
the American people to give up their rights?
Well, they don't convince the American
lawyers
people.
Lawyers are scum. Like, that's how they convinced it.
Yeah,
it's not an issue in elections, right? You start talking about class action suits as a candidate, and everybody's eyes glaze over.
Yeah. And this is Citizens United. I mean, that's the fact is, you don't have to convince people. Nobody had to convince people to give up their rights. Congress is going to take the rights away regardless of what they think because they don't know about it. And, you know, that brings up another thing. I think people would tend to think class actions, that has nothing to do with me. Well, if you have a credit card or you rent cars or you go to hotels or you have a cell phone or any of those things, this has a great deal to do with you.
How's that?
And it's because... Well, I'll give you some examples. So you rent the car, and they're very competitive. You rent the car because it was the most competitive price. And then you get the actual bill, and the car was substantially more than you thought because of the taxes. But unknown to you, the $17 tax in there doesn't even exist. They've got it listed on the thing. It doesn't exist. It's fraud. There's a class action that you couldn't do anything about if there wasn't a class action.
You wouldn't even know about it unless somebody discovered it.
AT&T tells everybody, if you do this, that, and the other thing, we'll give you a free phone. You get the free phone. Next thing, they charge you money on your account. You say, why? Well, that's the tax on the phone and class action. My wife and I just shopped. We stayed down in Scottsdale, and we shopped for the right hotel. We found the one that met our specifications, and it was the best price. And we stayed and had free breakfast and all that. And then at the very end of our stay, after a week, we get the bill that shows that they're charging us $8 a day to park the car in the parking lot. You know, those are the kind of things, and I'm not saying that's legally wrong. Maybe they can do that. But those are the kind of things that end up being class actions. You know?
Corporations can be kind of sneaky. I mean, I noticed in... we're visiting our old haunts in New York. Every hotel, even though it's got a crummy little room with three bicycles, charges you a resort fee now. So you get the bill, and then you'll find, and some of them are like $55
a day,
resort
fee. Some of them, there are class actions because there was no resort fee. They just put it on the bill. People don't question that. I was telling Klaus this morning, the most satisfying class actions I've ever worked on were representing employees where the corporation has, through malfeasance or outright crime, destroyed the corporation and down went the employees' entire pension plans. And I was telling Klaus, if there was ever an argument capital punishment, it is people who run corporations into the ground and take the employee's pension plan down with them.
And take a bunch of millions of bucks for themselves.
Have a golden parachute on the way out. We had that exact thing happen in Montana.
What I like about that is studies show that capital punishment would be effective in those cases, where it's almost completely ineffective.
Yeah. What is the parachute, right? Yeah.
Well, the way they use it, you know, in crimes of passion, that's completely ineffective. People put...
But I've been, in the last few years, I've been involved in two cases where we brought action against the corporations. Primarily, we were recovering money from their insurance, kind of the directors and officers insurance. And in both cases, people were required to invest or be in that pension plan, which was all invested in the company's stock. And then the company was driven to the ground through absolute malfeasance and conflicts of interest. And then people lost it, and we recovered the money from the insurance companies. And thank God, these were not criminal enterprises. These were stupid people. And insurance covers stupidity. It doesn't cover crime. Well,
and that said, I think we've all, not all, but most of us, or many of us, have gotten checks for $1.14, I remember, from MCI back in the '80s or '90s.
Yeah, I get those two $7.34 if you fill out this form.
Somebody brought a case against AT&T, but they split off that division. And so AT&T goes on fat and happy and rich, but I get a check for $2.06 as a part of the class action settlement.
Now, I badmouthed the Class Action Fairness Act, but let me say a couple things about it. There have been abuses out there, and you know, there are lawyers, and damn few of them, but there are lawyers out there who will abuse any system, and they'll find clients to abuse a system. And the Class Action Fairness Act put in place things that would make it more difficult to game the system. And they're good things. And one of them is that the court must approve the settlement. And the court's got criteria they have to look at. You know, is this just a settlement that benefits the corporation and benefits the counsel who get big fees, but the, you know, everybody else gets $1.71? And is this valid? Is it? And this is particularly true of coupon settlements. I mean, many of these things are settled on coupon settlements where you get a coupon that gives you so much off the next car you
I've
buy
gotten those,
or something like that. And the truth is that coupon settlement is probably worth a great deal to the company. They're not giving anything up.
So my $5 coupon is worth more to them than it is to me.
That's entirely possible.
Drags you into the store, right?
And the court now is also required to look at the attorney fees. If it's a coupon settlement, does that really merit some big attorney fees? So there are things that the Class Action Fairness Act did, but unfortunately, the overall import of it was it just has made class action so much more difficult, as you pointed out.
Well, the truth is that anything you have, somebody's going to abuse it. You have a bank, there's going to be a bank robber. You know, you have support for people who lose their jobs, unemployment. Somebody is going to pretend that they're unemployed when they're not employed. There's always going to be crooks with us, and that's why we have laws and punishments. And
if a consumer hasn't seen any circumstance that would merit a class action, they aren't looking at their accounts and papers properly. Because all you have to do is look at your MasterCard bill any month. And if you're like us, we put everything through MasterCard. But if you look at that bill, and you have to look at it every month, because if you're not careful, you're going to find out that somebody's billing you monthly for something you didn't agree to. They sent you something and with a note that said, if you don't send this back or refuse it, you bought it. Well, and you can't do that.
They did that to me, and I think it was 3 or 4 years, because I saw this charge on the credit card, Greg, and I thought it was something my wife was buying, because it sounded something like a fitness. And I thought, well, maybe she's, you know. And I finally said, you know, are you doing this? Where is this? Why are we being charged this? And then I went and demanded my money back, and Chase Bank gave me part of the money back for these fraudulent charges. But part of it was my not doing what you're saying, which is looking carefully at the credit card charges each month. And so now I rigorously act. If I see something that I don't know what it is, I ask. And I think that's what you have to do, folks, is keep a close eye on this. That charge of the credit card was a really there have been federal legislation now that has controlled the rip-offs of credit cards. I think the people who fought so hard to get that legislation through got no credit for doing anything to anybody. You know, and I think Elizabeth Warren and some other people were involved in that. They campaigned and got a much more much fairer system of charges and stuff. I don't think anybody, you know, they don't think they got any credit for that. I guess the question I asked, you know, earlier, and Mike was talking about, is it really then? Well, why there's a lot of hatred of trial lawyers. There's a lot of anger toward trial lawyers. There's a lot of anger toward plaintiff suits. When you go in with a plaintiff suit in a conservative area, they're all against you from day one. How did that something happen besides to convince people that to give up their rights, to the fact and I don't think that they imagine when they're on a jury that they could end up in the situation.
Yeah, it didn't happen. It didn't just happen. It was an extremely concentrated effort to poison. And Karl Rove was a major figure behind that, to poison the term plaintiff's lawyer, to poison. It used to be called the American Trial Lawyers Association. They poisoned the word trial lawyers so badly that the organization had to change their name to the American Association for Justice, because it would be hard for them to poison the word justice.
Right. And they did trial lawyers became like a whipping boy for Republicans and conservatives.
Absolutely.
And if you don't use trial lawyers when you're injured, folks, you're just going to be injured. I mean, I don't know what else to say about it.
How did they poison it, Greg? What did they do?
They hauled up all kinds of statistics, most of which were not true, and they created bogeymen. They had people. First off, in 1985, 1986, we went through a tremendous hard insurance market. Immediately, they saw the opportunity to blame that on lawsuits.
Right.
Blame it on, you know, and they ran all those ads about.
It was all anecdotal.
The McDonald's coffee case. Yeah.
What was the story on that?
It took 20 years for the truth of that to come out.
The McDonald's coffee case.
That was really used, folks, to beat up the whole idea of a legitimate lawsuit by anybody.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And so here's the McDonald's coffee case. A woman spills coffee in her lap and she gets millions of dollars. And here's the actual facts. She was 81 years old. McDonald's, the coffee, well, let me ask you this. How many of you have ever spilled coffee in your lap? Raise your hand. How many of you went to the emergency room with third degree burns and had permanent injuries from it? Now, what happened?
Like this lady did.
And so,
that is completely buried, though, Greg.
Right.
And stories about this.
But your coffee that you brew at home is like at 125 degrees. McDonald's had a policy of keeping their coffee up at anywhere from 185 to 205 degrees.
Oh.
20 seconds in your lap will cause third-degree burns. She went through debridement tanks. Her genitals were burned. She had to have new skin put on. Her medical expenses were $220,000. Her attorneys wanted just her medical expense. That's what she asked for. McDonald's told her to go pound
sand. That's all she asked
for.
She didn't ask for millions of dollars.
And
her 81-year-old skin.
And what people don't realize is that there's a jury that sat and heard that evidence for a week or two. They heard every piece of evidence. The judge screened every piece of evidence and all the experts and all that. And when they got done, they were so incensed about what McDonald's had done that they gave a $2.2 million verdict. And guess what? The appellate court took it away. She only got a couple $100,000 in the end. The jury thought that, and what the jury did was entirely rational. They gave her 1 day's profits from the sale of coffee at McDonald's. So that's where the $2 million. They paid her medicals and gave her $2 million, 1 day's profit.
But they picked this one case. They misrepresented
Absolutely.
It, and they convinced
Absolutely.
A lot of people that all the cases are illegitimate
Absolutely.
And that now your coffee's going to be cold.
And it's simply human nature. We're seeing this today, by the way, with the kind of racism. And that is, if you are getting more than me, and anybody who's worked in a workplace of larger than three employees, if somebody gets a dollar more than someone else, there's going to be a fight over that dollar, and they'd rather see that dollar denied from you than them brought up even. It's just human nature. If you're getting something that I'm not, then I am going to vote for taking it away from you.
Yeah, in my experience in a corporation is that we tried to bring in the union. Biggest restaurant corporation in America. We tried to bring in a union. We lost by one vote. Within a year, we had all been fired for cause.
Yeah.
They came up with a cause.
Yeah.
And the federal government protects you while you're having the union election, But once you have the union election, the feds go away and the company's free to do whatever they want if they can come up with some sort of excuse.
Well,
I ran into a woman about they fired me fairly early because I was one of the leaders of doing this. But I ran into a woman. She was the last one of the people who supported the union. And they said, now they got us all. I'm the last, and that was that.
In the last minute, that you know, in this whole discussion, how do regular people, how do rank and file, how do normal people have a voice? And this show is about having a voice through class action suits. But the other way people had a voice was through unions. Unions, I mean, just to fight the power, to be able to, not even just fight the power, to have a seat at the table with the power, that is what and we learned that in World War II. We came back from that horrible, horrible experience with, we thought, a method for people to have a voice. And once those voices started being effective and being heard, then they got attacked and eliminated, and of course, we got Jimmy Hoffa movies all of a sudden still in 2020 are winning awards. But, you know, corrupt leadership somehow makes – that doesn't make the idea bad. Just like in class action suits, in this case, a lie about a settlement doesn't make the idea of class action suits bad.
So, Greg, what do people need to know? What takeaways should they take about class action suits? The ability, really, you know, you're not going to be able to put the corporation in jail. First, although it's officially a person, it's not going to spend time at Sing Sing or something. So your only redress is economic lawsuit of some sort. And finding somebody who's willing to take a chance, a lawyer is willing to take a chance on a group, that you can do it. And that must be a complex, mind-boggling, think of it, Mike, getting 500 people to agree to this.
Huge risk. But so specifically, people simply need to be aware that when you're being wronged and you can't find an attorney to handle it, that's what class actions are about. If the attorney can't handle it because there's no financial viability, that may be what a class action's about. And you just need to pay attention. On the overall thing, we simply need to be aware that in our society today, more and more of the power and the opportunity and the money is sliding into a small group of people's hands through corporations. And this is one of those things. They have got to protect class actions.
And I'm sorry, it's with 2 minutes left, the situation that our guest today, Greg Monroe, is describing is fascism. And I don't know why people don't want to use that term. I do know why. But please, if you're working in the government today, please admit that the United States has a almost completely fascist system. We have a few institutions that are non-fascist, and I'm exaggerating only slightly. So when we have this corporate takeover of society so completely, that's it, and it's in cahoots with government. The only thing missing, Mussolini would be proud, if we had the military, then that would be complete and total fascism.
What office are you running for, Michael?
Yeah, I may disagree with the fascism requirement, but I agree with Greg's statement that the power and the money is getting more and more concentrated rather than less. Mike, we've got 1 minute.
Right. Well, here we are. And Klaus thinks he's going to say something, but I'm going to talk.
No,
right. Oh,
he gave you the finger.
Oh, I see.
Watch the fingers.
I got the finger.
Watch the fingers.
All right. So we're going
to.
We got some great shows coming up, guys. It's 2020. We got a great election season. We're going to have lots and lots of candidates on Democratic Perspective. So please, please, please tune in. Find our webpage, vvid.org, Verde Valley Independent Democrats.org. You will see a lot of archived shows. Some of our shows are a little complicated, like this one. This one will be up there in a day or two, and you can listen to it again. There's a nice summary there. So please go to. There's also a donate button there to keep us on the air. VVID.org is our website of Democratic Perspective. See you next week.
been listening to Democratic Perspective, brought to you by the Verde Valley Independent Democrats, a weekly talk show focusing on the political issues facing the Verde Valley, Sedona, Northern Arizona, and our nation at large. Catch us every Monday morning after the 8 a.m. news, right here on AM 780 KAZM. It's beautiful out there, folks. Have a great day.